So before I start the talk, there were a couple of questions. One was, should we sit with the eyes open or the eyes closed? If you are used to meditating with your eyes open, it is fine to meditate with your eyes open. If you are just learning, I would suggest that you meditate with your eyes closed. You'll probably find it easier, less distractions. If you're used to meditating with your eyes closed, meditate with your eyes closed. It's not really important. It's just a little bit easier to learn it with your eyes closed. There are certain forms of meditation that you do with your eyes open. This is not one of them. Doing the jhanas with the eyes open, I think, would be quite difficult. I have experimented with it. It's quite difficult. So, the eyes closed, unless you're a long-time practitioner of meditating with the eyes open. And then another question was, do we have to do watching the breath meditation? Can we do some other meditation? Yes, you can do some other meditation if you know it. Basically, I wanted to introduce that form of meditation first, one, because it's the oldest, seemed like a nice thing to do, and two, it's a very useful vehicle for getting into the jhanas and also for doing insight practice. When you notice where your mind has gone and you see habitually it goes to whatever it goes to, planning or worrying or whatever, that's an insight into how your mind works. So it's a very useful practice for many things. So I introduced it first. Tomorrow morning I will introduce another form of meditation, and each of the next mornings I will introduce other forms. So by the time you leave here, I guess we will have discussed at least 5 different forms of meditation. There's the loving kindness meditation we did last night. If you like that, you can do that meditation for every sitting, the whole sitting, if you want to. Okay? Just watching the breath, and then I'll introduce 3 more over the course of the week. So if you know some other meditation that you would prefer to do, it's okay with me. Thus have I heard. After the Buddha's enlightenment, he sat under the Bodhi tree for 7 weeks, enjoying the bliss of enlightenment. At first, he was very reluctant to try and teach what he had seen and understood. He felt it would be a vexation, a frustrating thing to do, because it is very subtle. And most people wouldn't have a clue what he was talking about. It is said that the king of the gods, the king of the devas, came to him in a vision and begged him to teach what he had learned for the benefit of gods and humans. And the Buddha looked around with his now very strong vision, and he saw that there were some people with only a little dust in their eyes who might be able to understand what he had come to see, what he had fully understood himself. He had figured out why there was suffering, and furthermore, he had made a breakthrough in consciousness such that he no longer suffered. So maybe there were some people with little dust in their eyes. The first 2 people he thought to teach were his previous teachers. He had learned meditation from 2 meditation teachers. Unfortunately, they had both died, and therefore he couldn't go show them what he had found. And then he thought about his companions, the people that he had spent 6 years doing very austere practices with. Now, these 5 companions had left him when he gave up his very austere practices, he had a decent meal. And when they saw that he was eating real food as opposed to trying to live on one grain of rice a day or one cup of water a day, they figured he was a slacker and they left him, because obviously this guy wasn't going to make any progress. But they were wrong. The Buddha achieved enlightenment, but he knew these five fellow seekers of the truth quite well, and he thought perhaps they had little dust in their eyes. So he set out to find them. And on the way, he encountered someone who was obviously very struck by the Buddha's countenance, the way he looked. And he said, "Are you a god?" And the Buddha said, "No." And the man said, "Are you a deva?" "No." "Are you a man?" "No." "Well, what are you?" And the Buddha said, "I am awake." This is what Buddha means. The Buddha is the awakened one, the one who is waked up. Eventually the Buddha came to the place Sarnath, to Isipatana, which is the deer park at Sarnath. Sarnath is near the present city of Varanasi in India. And there he found his five friends. And when they saw their old friend Gotama coming, they said, "Ah, it's Gotama the slacker. Let's ignore him. When he comes, let's don't pay any attention to him." But when he came near, they were also struck by his appearance. And they made a seat for him, and they gave him water to wash his feet, and actually were very nice and kind to him. And after they had exchanged pleasantries, he said to them, "Guys, I figured it out." And they laughed. "You know, right, yeah, you figured it out. We saw you. You were eating." He says, "No, no, no, I really did figure it out." "Yeah, yeah, sure, sure." He said, "Have I ever spoken to you like this before? Have I ever told you I really understood?" And they had to agree that no. In fact, more than any of them, this fellow Gotama seemed to be really, really working for something very hard and never getting there. And so after the third time he asked them to listen, they decided, well, they'd pay attention to what he had to say. And what he told them has come down to us as the Four Noble Truths. These four truths of how things are. And so that's what I want to share with you tonight. The first of the noble truths is the noble truth of suffering, of dukkha. I'll be using the word dukkha a lot. It usually gets translated as suffering. It can also be translated as unsatisfactoriness, as unpleasantness, as stress. It's the things that go wrong in the world. And the first noble truth is that if you're alive, you are subject to dukkha. And what is this dukkha? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress are suffering. Being attached to the unloved is suffering. Being separated from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. And what is birth? Whenever, in whatever kind of beings there is a coming to be, a birth, a coming forth, the appearance of the aggregates, the acquisition of the sense bases, this is birth. And what is aging? in whatever beings there are. There is aging, decrepitude, broken teeth, gray hair, wrinkled skin, shrinking with age, decay of the sense faculties. That is aging. And what is death? In whatever beings there may be, there is a passing away, a removal, a cutting off, a disappearance, a death, a dying, an ending, a cutting off of the aggregates, a discarding of the body. That is called death. And what is sorrow? Whenever by any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature, sorrow, mourning, distress, inward grief, inward woe, that is sorrow. And what is lamentation? Whenever by any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature and there is crying out, lamenting, making much noise for grief, making great lamentation, that is lamenting. So sorrow is directed inwards and lamenting is expressed outwards. And they are both brought on by any kind of misfortune. And what is pain? Whatever bodily painful feeling, bodily unpleasant feeling, painful or unpleasant feeling resulting from bodily contact, that is called pain. And what is sadness? Whatever mental painful feeling, mental unpleasant feeling, painful or unpleasant sensation from mental contact, that is called sadness. So we have pain that is physical, and we have sadness that is mental. And they're both suffering. And what is distress? Whenever by any kind of misfortune anyone is affected by something of a painful nature, distress, great distress, affliction with distress, affliction with great distress, that is called distress. And what is being attached to the unloved? Here, whoever has unwanted, disliked, unpleasant sights, sounds, smells, taste, tangibles, or thoughts, or whoever encounters ill wishers, wishers of harm, of discomfort, of insecurity, with whom they have concourse, intercourse, connection, or union, that is called being attached to the unloved. So being attached to the unloved is seeing something unpleasant, smelling something unpleasant. In other words, sensing something that is unpleasant or unwanted or disliked, or having to hang out with people that are disagreeable, people who wish you ill. This is called being attached to the unloved. And what is being separated from the loved? Here, whoever has what is wanted, liked, pleasant sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, thoughts, or whoever encounters well-wishers, wishers of good, of comfort, of security, mother or father or brother or sister or other kinsmen or friends or colleagues, and then is deprived of such concourse, intercourse, connection, or union, that is called being separated from the loved. If we have something we like, such as a pleasant sight, smell, touch, and it goes away, that's suffering, that's dukkha. Or if we have a friendship or relationship with someone that we like, someone we're close to, and that person leaves, that person dies, this is being separated from the loved, and this is suffering. And what is not getting one what one wants? In being subject to birth, the wish arises, oh, we wish we weren't subject to birth. And in being subject to old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress, the wish arises, oh, that we weren't subject to old age, sickness, death. This is called not getting what one wants. So this is what is meant by dukkha. It's all the things that go wrong in our life. In particular, it's the feelings engendered by all these things going wrong in our life. The sorrow, the lamentation, the pain, the sadness, the distress, the feelings that we have when we're separated from those that we love, the feelings that we have when we have to spend time with those who wish us ill, the wanting things to be one way and it just doesn't happen that way. This is what is meant by dukkha. And the first noble truth is that if you're alive, you are subject to dukkha. The second noble truth is the origin of this dukkha. And what is the origin of this suffering? It is craving which gives rise to rebirth, bound up with pleasure and lust, finding fresh delight now here, now there. That is to say, sensual craving, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. Now the word craving is a translation of the Pali word tanha, which literally means thirst. If you've ever been really thirsty, you know what this craving can be like. It can be all-powerful. If you've been somewhat thirsty, it tends to drive you. It tends to push you in a direction to get something to drink. It's this wanting to satisfy our thirst, this reaching out, this wanting to get it, this wanting to get the things we like, this pushing away the things we don't like. This craving is what is the origin of the dukkha. It says this craving gives rise to rebirth. If we want to look at our existence over many lifetimes, then it's the craving that brings us back every time. We didn't get it last time, we want to get it this time. Okay? But if you don't want to look at it over multiple lifetimes, you can look at it, well, you came on this retreat, you were on the one last time and you didn't get it last time, so you come back to another one in hopes of getting it this time. Or whatever we do repeatedly. Okay? We didn't quite get totally satisfied last time, so we'll try it again. This is also what is meant by rebirth. It's bound up with pleasure, and it finds fresh delight now here and now there. In other words, if we don't get it here, we'll go get it there. If we can't find enough pleasure doing Vipassana, maybe we can switch to doing Zen meditation, or maybe we could talk to the Tibetans, or maybe we give it up altogether and go find some marijuana, or maybe we should just read books, or, you know, we keep looking, we keep searching, we want to find the satisfaction for the thirst, whether it be a physical thirst, simple pleasure, or a deep spiritual thirst. We keep looking, we keep wanting to find it. And then it describes the three principal cravings. The craving, the sensual craving, the craving for sensual pleasures. The craving of the pleasure that comes from our sense organs. The eye wants to see pleasant things. The ear wants to hear pleasant things. We want to touch pleasant things. In the Buddhist terminology, the mind is thought of as the sixth sense, and what it senses is thoughts. So we want to think pleasant thoughts. So this is one of our cravings, is to satisfy the senses with pleasurable things. The other two cravings are the craving for existence and the craving for non-existence. Well, I think we all are familiar with the survival phenomenon. You know, we don't step in front of buses, right? Okay. That's the craving for existence. It also mentions the craving for non-existence. Committing suicide doesn't get you out of craving. It's just the opposite side of the same coin of craving for existence. You know, it's too painful, I think I'll go away. Right? So either one of these doesn't really solve the problem. It just produces craving, and the craving is what produces the suffering. Now, the craving for existence can be our own existence, or it could be for the existence of something pleasurable, like, you know, a candy bar to appear here. Or the craving for non-existence can also be the craving for something unpleasant to quit existing. The pain in my knee, you know, I need it to quit existing, to go away. These are the things that we crave. Sense pleasures, for nice things to come to us, for unpleasant things to go away. And where does this craving arise? Well, wherever the eye is in the world, the ear, the nose, all of the senses, wherever there are pleasurable sights, sounds, smells, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, eye contact, ear contact. So just being out into the world, seeing things, enjoying seeing things, the feelings that come from sense contacts, the perceptions. Perceptions means the recognition or categorizing. You know, you see a person and then you recognize it as your friend. Okay, this recognition is what is meant by perception. It brings pleasure. The volition in regard to sense contacts, I would like something that tastes good. I do not want something that tastes bad. The craving for pleasurable sights, sounds, and so forth can also produce craving. Craving itself actually can produce pleasure. The obvious example is sexual foreplay. Okay, craving itself, although it gets us into trouble, can be pleasurable itself. Thinking about pleasant sights, sounds, and so forth can produce this craving. Pondering pleasant sights, sounds, thoughts, whatever, can also produce this craving. It seems that anything we do can produce this craving, this desire to have it be mine. And this craving is what produces the suffering. First noble truth, life is full of dukkha. Second noble truth, craving produces dukkha. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of dukkha. And what is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering? It is the complete fading away and extinction of this craving, its forsaking and abandonment, liberation from it, detachment from it. In other words, if you want to get out of suffering, quit craving. It's pretty simple, at least to state. It's a little bit hard to do. Right? So, we're in this world that's full of dukkha. The dukkha is caused by craving. If you want to get out of dukkha, quit craving. Now, where should we quit craving? Well, in exactly the places where we crave, where there are pleasant sights, sounds, sense contacts, and so forth. The sutta basically repeats itself, saying, this is where craving arises, this is where craving is to be abandoned. Okay? Now, that's where you do it. How do you quit craving? I mean, it's very easy for me to say, don't crave anything, don't want anything, don't be attached to anything. Yeah, right. The fourth noble truth is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. It's the path that, when followed to its end, enables us to quit craving. It is the Eightfold Path, eight things to do, and they are right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, the Eightfold Path is like an eight-lane highway, and we go down all eight lanes simultaneously. It's not that we first practice right view, and when we get that correct, we then switch to right thought, and when we get that correct, we move on. No, we do all eight of them simultaneously. There is some nice feedback in that three of them have to do with moral conduct. As we begin practicing right action, right speech, right livelihood, it makes it easier to do the meditation practice, the parts that are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. When we do our meditation practice correctly, then it brings us wisdom, and we can have right view and right thought. Okay? So there is a nice feedback, but you have to do all of them all the time. Or at least you can't wait till you've finished with one before starting on the next one. Now, it's interesting. This formulation of the Four Noble Truths is given as a medical prescription, an Ayurvedic medical prescription. First, there is the diagnosis of the disease, suffering. It's caused by being alive, right? The disease is suffering, and it happens if you're alive. Okay? The second is the actual cause of the disease coming about, right? Craving. So we have the disease, suffering. The disease is caused by craving. The third is the prognosis. It's a good prognosis. It can be cured. Just stop craving. And the fourth is the actual medicine to take, the Eightfold Path. Right thought, right view, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, so what exactly are these eight things? This is, in my opinion, the most important part of the Four Noble Truths. The first three parts are somewhat theoretical. You know, you can get a nice understanding of what's going on, but it doesn't get you out of the problem. The fourth one is actually what to do. It's the directions that need to be followed. So, what is right thought? What is right view? It is the knowledge of dukkha, the knowledge of the origin of dukkha, the knowledge of the cessation of dukkha, and the knowledge of way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. In other words, the right view is the Four Noble Truths. It's kind of interesting. The Four Noble Truths have as the fourth truth the Eightfold Path, and the Eightfold Path has as the first fold right view, which is the Four Noble Truths. It's, in mathematical terms, self-referential. I mentioned last night that the Buddha's teachings were carried on as an oral tradition for approximately 500 years after he died. And then they began to be written down. They tended to evolve over time, over this 500-year period, and reached the form that we know them now only when they were written down. The earliest of his teachings that were written down, in other words, the teachings that reached their final form as we know them now, are in a collection known as the Sutta Nipata. And the essence of this collection of teaching is keep an open mind. Don't hold to fixed views, but really just be aware of what's going on. Don't try and figure it out. Really keep an open mind. So here in the Four Noble Truths, in the Eightfold Path, the right view is the Four Noble Truths. Okay? It's not that the world is like this, or the world was like that and has become like this and will become like that. None of this. It's just simply, hey, life is tough. It's caused by wanting. Quit wanting, things will get better. And by the way, here's a way to learn to quit wanting. Okay? No explanation of how the world began. No explanation of man's ultimate destiny. No explanation of the meaning of life. Right? A very practical medical prescription for getting out of pain. So that's what's meant by right view. What is right thought? Thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of harmlessness. Well, I think probably everybody in this room can go, yeah, I can think thoughts of non-ill will, at least some of the time. And I can think thoughts of harmlessness, at least some of the time. But renunciation, no, you can't take things away from me. You know, it's my stuff. I'm not giving anything up. I'm going to hang on to whatever I've got. I'm going to grasp onto. I desire things. I thirst for things. Especially in Western culture, we've been taught from very, very early on the importance of having nice things to hang on to. And I've never heard a talk or given a talk where renunciation was part of the talk that I didn't sense a large amount of resistance on the part of the listeners, myself included. However, think about all of the things that you own. Now, maybe you don't have very many things. I sincerely doubt, though, that anyone in this room can take all of their possessions in one carry from one place to another. In other words, you couldn't load up a backpack and a suitcase and carry all of your possessions from one place to another. You probably have quite a large number of things. Things that you need to take care of, that they are not stolen, broken, that they wear out too fast. And if they do wear out, you need to replace your things. We spend an enormous amount of energy taking care of our things. Now, admittedly, some of these things are quite useful. You know, I got a clock up here to keep me from going on and on too long and boring you. It's a nice thing to have up here. There's a tape recorder. It's a nice thing. It'll record this talk if you ever want to hear it again, right? There are things that are useful, but I think in Western culture, quite frequently we will find that we have many things that are actually fairly useless. Ayakema recommended that twice a year you go through all of your things, and anything you haven't used in the last 6 months, you give it to charity. You obviously don't really need that thing. Okay, 6 months gives you time to at least keep your winter clothes around. If you do it every 3 months, well, okay. But if you're not using a thing, you don't need that thing. this is how we in the West can start with our renunciation, is just realizing how many useless things we have, useless in that we don't use them, and sort of get rid of our burden of things. If we have that attitude that we don't need so many things, then this is the right thought of renunciation. If we have thoughts of being friendly to people, of sending them love, of not harming them, of not sending them ill will, then these are the thoughts of non-ill will and non-harmlessness. We will have many opportunities to practice this, because every evening I will do a guided metta, loving-kindness meditation. And we will have a chance to generate thoughts of love towards ourselves, towards people that we care deeply about, towards acquaintances, towards our enemies, towards literally every living being that we can think of. And what is right speech? Well, we talked about this one last night, refraining from lying, refraining from divisive speech so that you set one group of people against another, refraining from harsh speech, refraining from frivolous speech. Right now we are practicing noble silence, which, as I mentioned last night, is a bit different from total silence. Total silence is actually a little bit easier, but we have our jobs to do. Some of us are veggie choppers, some of us help with other things with preparation of the food. Sometimes it is necessary to talk. In order to practice right speech on this retreat, we are quiet except when it's necessary to talk to do our job. And then we very mindfully talk only about doing the job. You know, how fine do you want these vegetables chopped? Not, well, this is a wonderful knife, where did you get it? Okay? Just the things that are necessary to talk about to do our jobs. When we go back into the world, well, we have to worry about lying. Hopefully everybody here knows when they're telling the truth. The Buddha gave some very excellent things about telling the truth. He said, if something is not true and not useful, do not say it. If something is not true but is useful, do not say it. If something is not useful but is true, do not say it. If something is both useful and true, find the right time to say it. Okay, so this is a very good guideline. It not only has to be the truth, it has to be useful, and your timing needs to be right. There's a saying in English, timing is everything. Well, I don't know about it being everything, but it's certainly a very big thing. So if your friend comes up to you with a new haircut and says, what do you think of my haircut? And you think their haircut looks terrible, well, now, is that a useful thing to say? It might be. It might be more useful to say, well, it's interesting. It might be more useful to say, where did you get it? Okay? It's very important to think about what you're saying, not only in terms of its truth, but in terms of its usefulness. And as usual, it's up to you to figure it out, whether it's useful, whether it's true, and whether the timing is correct. And after you have said it and you get the reaction that you get, you will have feedback so that perhaps you will know whether it was useful or whether your timing was correct. The refraining from divisive speech. Jesus said that being a peacemaker was a very good thing. The Buddha is saying the same thing here. Being a peacemaker is right speech. saying words that cause people not to like each other, that bring discord, that bring a lack of harmony, is wrong speech. So we need to practice speech that brings peace. Harsh speech, I think I talked about that last night. We like to hear speech that's pleasant to our ears, that doesn't contain a lot of vulgar language, that isn't screamed. Therefore, we should practice that. And then the last one, frivolous speech, from one of the other suttas. Now, first I will say this was given to monks, not lay people, but what is frivolous chatter? Talk about kings, thieves, and ministers of state. Talk about armies, dangers, and wars. Talk about food, drink, garments, and lodgings. Talk about garlands and scents. Talk about relations, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, and countries. Talk about women or men. Talk about heroes, street talk, and talk by the well. Talk about those departed in days gone by. Rambling chit-chat, speculations about the world and about the sea. Talk about gain and loss. Doesn't leave much, does it? I go through it again. It's an interesting list. Talk about kings, thieves, and ministers of state. I think that's Time Magazine and the Nightly News just eliminated. Talk about armies, dangers, and wars. Well, that got rid of the rest of the news. Talk about food, drink, garments, and lodgings. Well, I think we cleared out another large section of magazines and books here, right? Gourmet Magazine, House Beautiful. Talk about garlands and scents. Well, go visit the perfume counter. Talk about relations, vehicles. Now there goes car and driver. Villages, towns, cities, and countries. I guess I shouldn't tell you my travel stories. Talk about women and men. I know men talk about women. I presume women talk about men. Talk about heroes. Guess I can't talk about the Giants or the 49ers or any other sports figures. Street talk and talk by the well. Or is that talk by the water cooler? Much of our talk at work is frivolous chatter. Now, it may be necessary to engage in such talk in order to make the environment in which you work a pleasant one. You know, the people that you work with want to talk about clothes or vehicles or heroes or whatever. Be aware that you are engaging in frivolous chatter. And if you get the chance to direct the conversation to something more meaningful, by all means, take the chance. It doesn't happen very often at work, but whatever. Talk about those departed in days gone by. Rambling chit-chat. Speculations about the world and the sea. I guess that goes philosophy. Talk about gain and loss. Well, no more stock market quotes. As I said, this was given to monks. Okay, to people who had dedicated themselves full-time to the spiritual path. However, I think we should at least pay attention to it, even though sometimes it is necessary to talk about gain and loss and vehicles and villages and whatnot. And what is right action? Refraining from taking life, refraining from taking what is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct. I spoke about these last night at some length, and so I'll just leave it at that. And what is right livelihood? Here, one having given up a wrong livelihood keeps oneself by right livelihood. In other words, any livelihood that's not wrong livelihood is right livelihood. That's pretty good, except, of course, what's wrong livelihood? Wrong livelihood is any livelihood that breaks one of the precepts, okay, that involves killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, wrong speech. Okay? So pretty much everything that we do would be classified as right livelihood. Some of the livelihoods that we do, shall we say, have more of a opportunity to provide spiritual growth than some of the other livelihoods that we do. Some of the livelihoods that we do, well, it's a little hard to tell whether they involve breaking the precepts. As I said, I'm a computer programmer. I create computer programs. What do the people who use the computer programs that I create do with these programs? Okay, I'm not killing anybody by producing a computer program, but maybe the person who buys the program I produce is using it to engage in killing. You sometimes have to look a little bit deeper if you produce something and see how what it is you are producing is being used. Amongst the wrong livelihoods that are specifically listed by the Buddha are being in the army, because it involves killing, making weapons, selling weapons, being a butcher, being a thief, gambling. Okay, because you can see these break the precepts. So if you want to do a right livelihood, just check out that what you do and what you produce doesn't involve breaking the precepts. So the first two, right view and right thought, are the wisdom aspects of the Eightfold Path. And the middle three, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, are the moral conduct, the sila part of the Eightfold Path. And the last three, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, are the concentration or the meditative part of the Eightfold Path. So what is right effort? Here, one rouses one's will, makes an effort, stirs up energy, exerts one's mind, and strives to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome mental states. One rouses one's will, etc., and strives to overcome unwholesome mental states that have arisen. One rouses one will, etc., and strives to produce unarisen wholesome states. And one rouses one's will, etc., and strives to maintain wholesome mental states that have arisen, not to let them fade away, to bring them to greater growth, to the full perfection of development. So there are four right efforts, the four supreme efforts. The first of which is to not let an unwholesome state that has not yet arisen arise. For example, you're driving home from work. It's been a fairly good day. You're in a relatively nice mood. You're driving down the road and somebody cuts you off. I mean, he cuts you off really bad. He like almost causes an accident. Well, your reaction, of course, is to get very angry. First, your reaction is fear, and then that immediately changes into anger. Well, if you can prevent that anger from arising by simply dodging their very careless move and going, wow, that was close, and not becoming angry, then you have made an unarisen, unwholesome state not arise. In other words, you were in a situation where you could become angry, but you didn't. That's the first of the right efforts. The second one, well, this guy cut you off and you did get very angry, and you are now very angry at this person who just threatened your life, and you realize you're angry, and you realize that, well, okay, I survived it, and this person in the car in front of me is not paying any attention to my anger. In fact, the only person that is being affected by my anger right now is me. And you let go of your anger because, well, there's no point in being angry. That's making an arisen, unwholesome state go away. That's the second one. The third one is to make an unarisen, wholesome state arise. When we do the loving kindness meditation at the end of the evening, we are practicing making an unarisen, wholesome state, a state of love, to arise. And the fourth one is to make a wholesome state that has arisen to remain. Okay, so we start doing the loving kindness meditation and you begin to generate these loving feelings, and we finish the loving kindness meditation and you're able to sustain this open-heartedness, this feeling of friendliness towards everybody that lives. You are making the arisen wholesome state to continue. So this is the four right efforts. What is right mindfulness? Here one abides contemplating body as body, having put aside hankering and fretting for the world. One is aware and mindful. Okay. The first foundation of mindfulness is the body. And we contemplate the body as body. By watching the breath, by simply observing the breath going in and out, we are doing the first foundation of mindfulness. We're watching body as body. We are aware of our body's functioning. The second one is to abide contemplating feelings as feelings. The word vedana in Pali is translated as feeling, but it doesn't mean emotion. What feeling means when you hear it, when someone is discussing Buddhist terminology, means the immediate reaction of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay? So the second foundation of mindfulness is to be aware of our reaction to sense contacts, whether the reaction is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You can do this with hearing. Here's a simple meditation that you can do. You sit there, you watch your breath a little bit till you get quiet, and then you shift your entire focus to just hearing, right? Whatever sounds there are. Okay? We're quiet in this room, but it's usually not totally quiet. There may be sounds outside. You may hear an airplane go over. Okay. The sound of an airplane going over is actually rather unpleasant. Now, the thought that comes with it, yeah, I'm going to be on an airplane next week, and I'm flying off to India, and I'll see my guru, or I'm flying to Thailand, and I'll lie on the beach, or whatever. The thought that comes afterwards may be pleasant. But the actual sound itself may be unpleasant. Okay? So you want to look at the sounds and notice, are they pleasant or unpleasant? Do you like the sound or do you not like the sound? Or is it just totally neutral? This is what is meant by mindfulness of feelings. You can do it with sounds, you can do it with sights, you can do it with basically any sense contact, including your thoughts. Was that a pleasant thought? Was that an unpleasant thought? Or was it just a thought? The third foundation of mindfulness is contemplating mind states as mind states. This basically means knowing whether you're angry, knowing whether you're caught in desire, knowing whether you're upset, knowing whether you're being mindful, knowing whether you're in a good mood, knowing whether you're in a bad mood. Okay? It's just simply to know what your mental state is. It's a pretty simple thing to do. There are some 16 of them that are given. I'll discuss them perhaps a bit more detail if we have time. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it says here, contemplating mind objects as mind objects. It's also usually given contemplating dharmas as dharmas. Dharma being used in this sense as teaching. In other words, to take a teaching like the Four Noble Truths that we're discussing tonight and just think about it. This is being mindful, if you stay on the subject. To take something like the five hindrances or the seven factors of enlightenment or any one of these other many lists that come down to us and staying right with it, just looking at it as this is what's going on. So that's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And then the last of the Eightfold Path. And what is right concentration? Here, secluded from sense desires, secluded from unwholesome states of mind, one enters and remains in the first jhana, which is with initial and sustained attention to the meditation subject, and is filled with delight and joy, and with the subsiding of initial and sustained attention to the meditation subject, and by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, one enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without initial and sustained attention to the meditation subject, is born of concentration and is filled with delight and joy. And with the fading away of delight, remaining imperturbable, mindful, and clearly aware, one experiences in oneself the joy of which the noble ones say, happy is he who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness. One enters the third jhana. And having given up pleasure and pain, and with the former disappearance of gladness and sadness, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, and purified by equanimity and mindfulness. This is called right concentration. In other words, the Buddha's definition of right concentration is the jhanas. So I guess we should talk more about the jhanas, but we'll do that another night. We've sort of run over the time a little bit, but then we had a lot to talk about early. But if there are questions about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, we have a little bit of time we can take for that. Yes. Right. The difference between suppressing and expressing, and when should you suppress and express, especially in relation to anger. It's never good to suppress. If you suppress, particularly anger, it will show up some way, somehow, as depression, as going out and injuring yourself. One way or another, suppressed anger reappears. So it's actually not possible to effectively suppress anger or any other negative emotion. You can pretend to suppress it and wait for it to show up in some other form. Now, it's good not to have these negative emotions. However, when you are angry, you are indeed angry. Okay? It's important to recognize that you're angry. It's also important to realize that the anger is hurting you as much as or more than the person to whom it is directed. Okay, to realize that this anger, although it feels very righteous, isn't actually a useful thing to have. You cannot push the anger down to make it go away. It's more seeing clearly that you are angry and that the anger is not useful. The Buddha compared being angry to picking up hot coals and throwing them at the person towards whom you are angry. Now, who is guaranteed to get burned? The person who picks up the hot coals with their bare hand. The person towards whom the anger has been directed, if they're smart, will just jump out of the way. Okay? It can be very frustrating to be terribly angry at someone and they don't care. Right? That's actually a quite healthy reaction on their part. It seems like, though, they're just making you more angry. Anger is a very difficult one to deal with. I have led a number of small groups, and when the groups start, I say, okay, what would you like to talk about next time? 90% of the time, what people want to talk about is anger. It's a very big topic. Tomorrow night, I'm going to talk about the five hindrances, the second of which is anger and ill will. And so I'll give some more details about it. But the important thing is to see, what does it feel like to be angry? What is it accomplishing to be angry? And if possible, to substitute something like compassion, to realize that the person who did this awful thing to you that made you angry is obviously, well, a person who needs a lot of compassion. If they are leading a life that is so terrible and inconsiderate that they would do something that awful to you, well, certainly they need some compassion. They must be quite miserable to have committed such a terrible act. Now, at first it may not be very easy to see that. So the most important thing to do with anger at first is to be aware of it in all of its forms. To see what effect it's having on you, and to see if there is a way to that you can just step beyond it. But suppressing it, pushing it down, doesn't work. Neither does indulging it. Realizing that you're angry and just going with it and being angry and angry and angry and angry. Well, that only makes you angry. Being angry is actually a very unpleasant place to be. And it's not an easy thing to work with. It really takes practice to watch it, to see what it's doing, and to see where it's got you hooked, and to see how you can get unhooked from it. So hopefully that addresses your question a bit, and I will talk about it some more tomorrow night. Yes?
Obviously, there's pain and suffering in the world, but there is also evil.
Yes.